to the lightning round.
Welcome.
Hello, and welcome to episode 14 of the Dave Kirshner Lightning Round Podcast. It is week 19 of the 46th Quadrennial Hunger Games. Woo! We're getting close to the end of May, which means my wife is going to be home for 3 months, which means I'm likely going to pause the podcast during the summer months. You know, you guys are all going to be outside doing stuff, gardening, being busy, and I'm going to be doing the same thing. So I think we are going to pause the podcast after next week's show. So that'll be episode 15, and then we'll pick back up at the end of the summer. But I do have some good news. My episode 4 of my 5-part fictional series, the audio is complete and has made it through the ACX Clearinghouse audio file checkers. And so part 4 is now available on audio. If you'd like a free copy of parts 1, 2, 3, or 4 in audio format, shoot me an email. You can do it through the website, or you can just use djkpublishinghouse@gmail.com. I'll say it again, djkpublishinghouse@gmail.com. It's all one word. Shoot me an email, and I will reply with a voucher code that's given to me by ACX. And you can get a free copy. So if you're listening and you like audiobooks, shoot me an email. And you can get free copies of parts 1 through 4. So that takes care of that. And, oh, I did want to give you an update. So I made the dandelion wine. I even put a video of it out on YouTube. And the last piece of instruction on the dandelion wine recipe says, cork lightly. I did not. And I wound up with a bottle because I wound up with 4 bottles of dandelion wine. That came out of 5 quarts of dandelion heads and 5 quarts of water. And, I went through the whole, it's a week long process. I went through the whole thing, you know. I strained this, I cooked that, and then I strained it some more, and then I added all this other, you know, followed the whole recipe from top to bottom and screwed up the last step. So all 4 bottles blew their corks, but only one of them dispensed with its liquid gold. So I spent like 30 minutes cleaning all this crap up, and now the 3 that I still have that are still full have been lightly corked. So if you ever try it, follow the friggin' directions. I'm a cautionary tale. What can I say? Okay, so that's that. That just makes me laugh. So, normally, I would lead into current events, but in my write-up last week, I referred to some of the topics that I was talking about in current events as low-hanging fruit from the Biden jackassery tree. And John Jeffers, he thought that was just freaking hysterical, and he said, you know, that should be your calling card. And you should have a dedicated segment. So we have so instead of calling it the current events or getting into current events or news or whatever you want to call it, it's now going to be referred to as the Biden Jackassery Minute. So here we go. actually just spent like the last 30 minutes going online trying to find a download of the TV show Jackass theme song. It was on MTV years ago. And I found it. So that's the intro music to the Biden Jackassery Minute. So, oh, let's start with Comrade Kamala. She hammered Trump for 4 years. Emoluments clause, emoluments clause. He doesn't disclose everything. Ah, you can't just put it in a trust. That's not fair. We need to see all of your assets all the time. She hasn't even been in office 6 months. And she just got owned by some reporters that have discovered that she's violating her own ethics pledge because she and her husband are shoving their assets into a trust. And we're not talking like small amounts. We're talking about real estate in California where everything is overpriced. Multi-million dollar condos and loft apartments and homes and different places. And you're just like, wow, I thought we were going to be transparent and bipartisan. But apparently, that was just another plank in the bait and switch mantra that they'd employed during their election campaign. So, but I still contend that she's off being trained to be the leader of the free world once they punch old Joe's ticket. Speaking of old Joe, he was all giddy. They brought an electric vehicle over to the White House for him to look at, and the press was like, "Oh, look at Joe Biden. He's driving by himself." And blah blah blah. No, he wasn't. There was a dude in the passenger seat. And the vehicle that they brought, this is how little they trust Joe Biden. They don't even trust him to drive a freaking car. Because the vehicle they brought had two steering wheels. The guy driving was the dude in the passenger seat. Not, "Stumbling Joe." And that wasn't him. He had his hands on the steering wheel, but I'm sure they took his pedals away too. So he couldn't step on the gas or the brake. You can't make this stuff up. You really can't. All right. Anyway, so the Supreme Court, they came back with a unanimous decision that protects the Fourth Amendment because Biden's DOJ wanted them to uphold the use of community caretaking as a reason why police or agents, federal agents, didn't need to get a warrant to search your home. And the Supreme Court came back and said, look, you guys are applying the law incorrectly because that standard that we ruled on in the 70s actually applied to a vehicle that was in police custody. So you weren't violating anybody's Fourth Amendment rights. You already had possession of the property. But what these guys did is they went into a guy's home in Rhode Island to go seize two weapons with no warrant. And the Supreme Court said, sorry guys, you did it wrong. Community caretaking exception does not apply because you entered the person's home. Okay? So, they actually, by making that, they overturned a First Circuit Court of Appeals ruling, and I think a Fifth Circuit. But that's not where anything else, you know. This is why this is in the Biden Jackassery Minute. The DOJ signed an amicus brief for this case and said, quote, "The touchstone of the Fourth Amendment is reasonableness. For criminal investigations, this court has generally incorporated the warrant clause into the Fourth Amendment's overarching reasonableness requirement. But it has not generally done so far. Wait, but it has not generally done so for searches or seizures objectively premised on justifications other than the investigation of wrongdoing. The ultimate question in this case is therefore not whether the respondent officer's actions fit within some narrow warrant exception, but instead whether those actions were reasonable. And under all the circumstances here, they were. So, long story short, end quote, by the way, that I'm done. Long story short, the Biden administration wanted the Supreme Court to uphold warrantless searches in your home so that they could shoehorn every one of those activities into this community caretaking clause. Do you understand that? That's how draconian the Biden administration is being by going after and saying, no, with their amicus brief, they're saying, no. The police should be allowed to enter your home at any time as long as it's reasonable. So if I've got a crazy-ass neighbor, which I do, who is so far on the left, she's looking out over the Pacific, I'm telling you, if for some reason she gets a wild hair and she calls the cops because she sees me walk out to the car with my range bag and some cased firearms, and she gets a little nervous because it's a big case and it's got a big black scary gun in it. Ah! And she calls the cops. According to Biden's DOJ, those cops could come to my house and call it community caretaking because my neighbor was upset. So they need to remove the guns from my possession in my home without a warrant so that my neighbor will feel better. No. And thankfully, the Supreme Court was paying attention and slapped all of the lower courts and the administration with some common sense. So there you have it, folks. Oh, and in other FBI news, 2.5-3 years after the fact, the FBI reclassified the Scalise shooting at the baseball practice as what they had originally classified as suicide by cop. Now they've reclassified it as domestic terrorism, which is what they should have done anyway, but, you know, because Trump is there, orange man bad! So, you know, it was suicide by cop. You know, it's total crap. And this one came across my desk, and I actually had to chuckle, because, of course, it's California, and, of course, California's doing everything they can to drive business out of California, so that, I don't know, the state can take over, but I don't know what their logic or the rhyme or the reason is. But apparently, a law in San Francisco legalizes shoplifting for up to $950. I didn't read that wrong, and you didn't hear it wrong. It legalizes shoplifting up to $950. The cops can't be called. The business owners can't stop you, because as long as it's under $950, it's now considered legal. So, guess what happens? Little gangs of hoodlums have gotten together, and they put together little crews, and they just literally go around the city. They run into the store, they grab a whole bunch of crap off the shelves, and then they run out. And you're not allowed to stop them, you're not allowed to say boo. It's completely legal in San Francisco. This is the crap storm that Democrats want to unleash on the rest of the country. Crazy-ass laws like this. So what happens? Well, 17 CVS stores, a dozen Rite Aids, a number of other discount stores, shopping centers, and grocery stores, and just small mom-and-pop shops, they all said, we're out, because the amount of inventory that you're stealing is putting us out of business. And if we can't stop people from doing it, and it's not illegal, then we're out. So good luck. So all of these stores now are closing in San Francisco or moving outside of San Francisco city limits so that that stupid Proposition 42 rule doesn't apply. Proposition 47, sorry. So if you get outside the city limit, then law and order actually exists. Rule of law actually exists outside of San Francisco city limits. So then you can actually stop them. So all these businesses are leaving. So the people that live in actual San Francisco city limits, they're running out of options fast because of their stupid leaders on city council that have legalized the stealing of $950 worth of materials and goods, inventory, whatever you want to call it, as long as it's under $950, it's perfectly legal. That's about seven shades of stupid, folks. And speaking of seven shades of stupid, a member of Spain's parliament was suspended by Twitter, the Twitterati, the Twatterazis, because he deigned to put on Twitter that men cannot give birth. He literally wrote, but he wrote in Spanish, he says, "This is a lie. A man cannot get pregnant. A man neither has a uterus nor ovaries." So he speaks the truth. He's got science on his side. And the Twitter Nazis went crazy. And the PC left went absolutely ballistic. So they suspended him. Twitter, in their suspension, said that the Spanish member of parliament violated its platform rules against hate speech. What the hell? Oh, man. Twitter specifically cited rules against threatening, harassing, or encouraging violence against people on the basis of sexual orientation, gender, and gender identity. I don't care if you identify as a man. If you are not genetically predisposed to be a woman, you cannot give birth. Science fact. I'm sure they're doing all kinds of crazy stuff with surgeries and they're taking somebody's uterus and shoving it in a guy, but when they turn his outie into an innie if he wants to do the surgery or whatever, but if you're born a biological male and you're functioning in society as a biological male, whether or not you identify as a biological male is irrelevant. You are physically incapable of giving birth and becoming pregnant. This is right up there with banning Dr. Seuss. What a... I'm telling you, that's why it's called the Biden Jackassery Minute. That one didn't have anything to do with Biden, but, you know, it's his world. We're just trying to get a nut. It's funny stuff. But, speaking of little communists and socialists and all that fun stuff, so the Palestinians have been launching rockets into Israel to the tune of about a 10-to-1 ratio. And, of course, the U.S. media and the U.S. Democrats, they're all over Israel for retaliating, for firing back. I'm sorry, what happened to the right to self-defense? Apparently that doesn't exist. So you've got that going on. Then you've got these little hooligans of pro-Palestinian mobs. They're running around L.A., and they're literally berating patrons at restaurants and asking them if they're Jewish. And if they are, they beat the shit out of them. Where's a cop when you need one? Or better yet, why aren't these people armed? Oh, wait, it's California. I forgot. Bunch of idiots. But here's the kicker. Ilhan Omar's daughter, right? So the member of the squad. Her daughter, this little budding communist, she's calling for communist revolution. And she literally added the communist hammer and sickle to her Twitter bio. You can't make this stuff up, folks. Oh, man. So, I got two more things. One, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy says that he will not support the bipartisan legislation for a 9/11 style commission to investigate the Capitol riot, because Nancy Pelosi is only letting them look at January 6th. She refuses to be bipartisan. She will not expand the scope of that commission to include 8 months of previous riots in every major city in the country that were propagated by BLM and Antifa. They are not in scope, she says. We're not allowed to do that. No, no, no. We're only going to talk about Orange Man Bad and his words that we parsed to make into an argument that he incited the riot, which is why we tried to impeach him again. You're so full of crap. So Kevin McCarthy said, go pound sand. And, I mean, but it's probably going to amount to nothing because, you know, the key word there is minority leader. So we're still a minority in the House, and it's just run amok. But the last thing is what Biden has done, because so he propagated the border crisis. Because Orange Man Bad, I'm going to put it on a reel. I got to have a magic button on my keyboard. Orange Man Bad. Because it's all we heard for 4 years. But my point is, he was so hell-bent on undoing anything associated with Trump and Trump's legacy that he totally screwed the pooch on the border. So what they're doing now is they're putting unaccompanied minors on airplanes in the middle of the night from these border towns, and they're flying them to small airports in Tennessee. Blackburn's pissed. She's like, you didn't tell us you were doing this. You're flying them into our state without permission. So shit's about to hit the fan in Tennessee. But I'll tell you what, that bunch of redneck down there know how to grow down some moonshine and blow shit up. So, who knows what will happen there. But they're flying unaccompanied minors into Tennessee and then putting them on buses and then dispersing them throughout the Southeast. So, there's one fun thing. And then there were two facilities that the ICE was using. And doctors there were like, what was that doctor's name? Oh, I know. Joseph Mengele. There are doctors in these facilities that were like taking these illegal aliens and giving them hysterectomies. They didn't want the hysterectomy. They didn't have a medical purpose or need for the hysterectomy. They just went in and did it. That's crazy. That's Biden. That's under Biden's watch. So Biden's ultimately responsible. But getting back to the last thing on the Biden jackassery tree, he has spent, or his administration, has spent $3 billion taxpayer dollars just to house the illegal immigrants because of the problem he caused at the border. You can't make it up! They're spending $3 billion to build shelters and for construction, and then the housing of these kids in various shelters, hotels, motels. They're spending $3 billion. Here's a thought. Take the $3 billion, finish the freaking wall, and then tell them to do it right. Show up with the correct paperwork and a valid reason that you need to flee some Central American hellhole and you're requesting amnesty and exile or whatever the right term is for our country. That's the crazy part. All right, that brings it. The Biden jackassery minute officially lasted 15 minutes. But, you know, you get the idea. Moving on. And now we pause for some shameless self-promotion. If you like the show and are curious as to how my mind works, then pick up my 5-part fictional series today. In a nutshell, over the course of When Rome Stumbles, Hannibal is at the gates by the dawn's early light, colder weather, and a time for reckoning, I crashed the big ag and financial industries, unleashed some jihadists and an EMP, Then we spend 20 years trying to evade a socialist dictator. All five parts are available in paperback and electronic formats. Parts 1 through 3 are in audio format, and parts 4 and 5 will be in audio format by the end of the year. Now back to the show. So to continue our conversation from last week around gardening, one of the things that I wanted to talk about was the incorporation of an orchard. So this could serve multiple purposes aside from fresh fruits and nuts. You can also, your orchard could be comprised of berry bushes and vine crops and vine fruits, I should say, like grapes and cantaloupe and honeydew and things like that. So, your orchard could serve multiple purposes, and it can be a very broad general term. But one of the things that I've been looking at doing is when I do get some property, is putting in a couple acre orchard, simply because of the sheer size of the trees. So if, and for me, for ease of maintenance, I would prefer to use miniatures or dwarf fruit trees, because they only get to be about 8 to 10 feet tall, and they bear fruit within 2 to 5 years, as opposed to some of the bigger trees, like a pawpaw or maybe a Chicago hardy fig tree. Those get 15 to 25 feet. You can get a cherry tree, a black gold. These are all trees that are suitable to my USDA cold hardiness zone. So the types of trees that I was looking at two types of apple trees in Honeycrisp and Wilson: a cherry tree, a fig tree, a pawpaw, a peach, a pear, and a plum. The reason why some of them are singles and some of them are doubles is that some of them are self-pollinating, like the cherry tree, the fig tree, and the peach. They're self-pollinating. I don't need bees. I just need wind. But the ones that are requiring a pollinator, like the apples and the pawpaw, you need to plant two of those. So that'll help the bees and other pollinators will help disperse the pollen accordingly, so it'll bear fruit. So the two apple trees, like I said, were Honeycrisp and Wilson. They take 2 to 5 years to bear fruit, and the Honeycrisp requires a pollinator, but the Wilson tree does not. And the two that I picked were dwarfs, so they'd get to 8 to 10 feet. The cherry tree, which is a cherry black gold, that takes 4 to 7 years for it to start bearing fruit. It's self-pollinating, but it gets 15 to 18 feet. So you got to figure out a way to either keep the tree trimmed up, or, you need to be able to feel comfortable on a ladder for harvesting. They do make those machines. It's really cool to watch. It's a machine that comes in, and it's almost like a clear-cutting machine, except it doesn't have a blade on it. And what it does is it comes up and it grabs the trunk of the tree about a foot or so above the base, where it meets the ground. And it literally just shakes the ever-loving hell out of that tree, and all of the nuts and fruits fall out. You see it a lot with almonds, and you see it a lot with olives. But you could probably do that. Maybe you probably don't want to do that for an apple tree, but you could probably do that for a fig. But I don't know, that's a pretty pricey piece of equipment. So, you might want to figure out a less expensive means to get your harvest. But of the ones that I chose, the Honeycrisp, the Wilson, the peach, the Bartlett pear, and the Fellenberg plum, those are all dwarf. And so they're all 8 to 10 feet when they're mature. So you really don't need to work. You got to prune them for maintenance. But you're not going to need to shape them or prune them for size, because, if you can go to Lowe's or Home Depot and buy a 10-foot fiberglass ladder, for 50, 60 bucks, and you know, you can harvest those without a problem. It's the pawpaw fig and cherry that get to 15 to 25 feet, 15 to 18 feet for the cherry. So that is something that I've wanted to think about and wanted to incorporate. The other piece of that, well, actually, there's three pieces to this puzzle. One is fruit trees, the other is nut trees, and the other one is berry and vined fruit. So all three of those, to me, equate to an orchard, and that's what I would dedicate that acreage to. So I found five nut trees that'll grow in my cold hardiness zone, and they're almond, chestnut, hazelnut, pecan, and walnut. The problem with those, okay, you need to make sure you put those on the north side of your orchard, because if you look at the pecan tree, the Missouri hardy is compatible with my cold hardiness zone, but it takes 10 to 20 years for it to bear its first nuts, and that tree will reach a size of 75 to 100 feet. That is an enormous tree. And if it's on the south side of your orchard, the rest of your trees aren't going to get any sunlight. They're all going to be shaded by that pecan tree. The other ones, the walnut and the chestnut, they get 30 to 40 feet. And the almond and the hazelnut are more manageable in, the almond is 12 to 15 feet. And the hazelnut's 18 to 25. Chestnut, hazelnut, and pecan require pollinators, so you'll probably have to plant more than one. And the almond and walnut are self-pollinating. The almond and chestnut take 3 to 4 years to bear fruit, or nuts in this case. The walnut's 4 to 5, and the hazelnut is 6 to 8. And like I said, the pecan is 10 to 20 years. So it could be a while before you see anything from your orchard. You know, you're going to get fruit first. You're going to get that pretty quick. But the nut trees aren't going to produce much, if anything, for at least 5 years. And then you're going to have to wait on two of them for a good fair amount, at least a decade. So that's something to keep in mind. And then the third piece of this puzzle is the berry and the vine fruit. So, I like to go out every spring, or not every spring, but I should say early summer. I'll take a day off of work when there's a raspberry farm, or I should say there's a farm about an hour away from me, and they've got just, I want to say, 30 acres of these berry bushes. And they've got raspberries and strawberries, and they've got blackberries and black raspberries and blueberries, and I mean, they got all kinds of stuff. I like to go out there and go pick my own, and I just find it really relaxing to do that. I do this so that I can make my own jams and jellies, and I'll go out there every year, and I'll probably put up 8 to 10 jars of different jams and jellies based on the stuff that I've picked. So it's very worthwhile because I don't have the land to do that right now, because I don't, you know, I live in my suburban nightmare. So I have to find other means to do that. And I don't necessarily want to get those ingredients from a grocery store, because I don't know what the chain of custody was in terms of, you know, where it was grown, how it was grown, what methods were used to get it there, all of that stuff. So I don't want to deal with that. So I go and pick my own, and I do that for fun. But in the garden proper that I do have, which is not, you know, it's big enough for our family, and it's big enough for me to put everything up, but I'll grow various vine fruits in there, cantaloupes and melons and watermelons and things of that nature. There's actually a website that you can go to. It's leafyplace.com, leafyplace.com/types-of-berries. So leafyplace.com/types-of-berries, and each one of those words is hyphenated, but leafyplace is one word. And it's basically, that's an article that you can read through that'll give you kind of the lowdown on 23 different berry varieties. And then if you see something that you like, I would tell you, go to the Stark Brothers website and put in your cold hardiness zone, and it'll tell you if it's compatible, and you can kind of work your way through the list to figure out what works in your general area. But outside of that, so the orchard, like I said, is three parts. You've got your fruit trees, you've got your nut trees, and then you've got kind of your vine and bush fruits, if you will, in your berry plants and grapes and melons of all different shapes and sizes and things of that nature. But I will say, if you're wanting strawberries, that is an invasive species, so you definitely want to put that in a raised planter away from everything else, because it will take over. I mean, if you've got the space for it. Otherwise, I wouldn't plant them in your backyard if you're in a suburban setting like I am. I would tell you to put that in a pot or a planter of some kind, just so that it can't spread. It's a super spreader, so you want to be very mindful of that. Now, beyond the orchard, now you need to think about how you're going to keep it all watered. And this is the second topic that I wanted to cover outside of the orchard, and that is ways that you can keep things watered. So in my setting, suburban setting, I've got rain barrels. And we get an average of about 22 to 25 inches of rain a year. So if you do the math, which is it's actually detailed out in the book on how to do the math to figure out what your catchment amounts would be. You know what? I'm just going to share it with you. So the basic math is your catchment area times your rainfall depth times 0.623. And that'll tell you how many gallons of harvested water you can get based off of your annual precipitation. In lay terms, to figure it out, I mean, you can just figure out what is the foundational dimension of your home, right? So if your home is, I'll just call it 26 by 26. That's the example I gave in the book. And that's my main home. And then my garage is 12 by 20. I've got a back porch that's 14 by 8. So if you take all of those and you add them all up, that gives me 1,028 square feet. So if I do all of the math correctly, that gives me about 1,000 gallons of water that I've collected. But that's not the real math, because a roof line is basically two right triangles back to back. So if you go out and you look at your roof, if you have any gable ends, it makes it a lot easier. But if you've got a cut up roof system, you're going to be doing some math. But I have just a standard, I don't have hip and valley. So I just have a normal rise on my roof. But it goes up 12 feet above the ceiling joists for the second story. So if you're looking at it spatially, my foundation says it's 28 feet. But it's two right triangles back to back. So it's actually 28 divided by 2, which is 14. So you do 14 as the length. But I also have an overhang. So now I got to add an extra foot for that. So now it's 15 feet, and then I go up at the right angle. I go straight up to my ridge line, and that's another, call it 14 feet. And then I've got the hypotenuse, which is the distance from the ridge all the way back down to my gutter. Okay, so there's the three sides of my triangle. And then you have to do that and figure that out and then multiply it by 2. That's the actual catchment area for your main roof. Then you do the math with the conversion factor and the annual precipitation, and it'll give you a hyper-accurate estimate for the amount of gallons of water that you could potentially capture just from your roof. So if I do just, you know, layman's math at the three roof structures that I have between the main house, the back porch, and the garage, in theory, I could capture over 14,000 gallons of water, okay? The previous catchment amount, I actually said it wrong. That was my square footage. My square footage was 1,000, but my catchment amount was 14,000. But if I do the hyper-accurate math, then I could, in theory, capture almost 25,000 gallons of water. Now, obviously, I can't store that. I can't dig up my backyard and put in a big old honking cistern because city ordinances says I can't do that. And we talked about city ordinances when we were talking about land purchases and things to look for. You want to avoid the HOAs and city ordinances, and that's one of the ones that I'm not allowed to deal with. I can have a rain barrel or two or three, but I can't have a dedicated cistern. And I'm not allowed to put in a well. Can you believe that? All that being said, if you're going to put in an orchard or some facsimile thereof, then you definitely want to have at least one, preferably more, spigots that you could put in there, like a hand pump, something that you could turn on. Those are fairly easy to install. They don't cost a lot of money, but you could install a little hand pump. That you can just lift the handle and the water will start to flow, and then you can water your trees or your vine crops, things of that nature. But outside of that, if you actually own some land, and I know, you know, based on other authors and other podcasts and people in the know, if you will, you know, it's a prepper's wet dream to be able to find some land that has some gradient and it has a natural spring, but most people are not going to find that combination. So what you can do is have a well installed uphill and then use gravity to fill an underground cistern, because the minute the water hits the air, you got to boil it. Okay, if it comes into contact with a roof structure of any kind, regardless of the material being used, you need to boil it. So if you can get it from underground using a well or a natural spring to feed an underground cistern, you don't need to boil that. And then you can still continue to use that gradient to bring water into the house, into your hot water heater, and do that. So that would be great in a long-term type of collapse or shutdown of any kind. But when it comes to the orchard, if you do find property that does have a gradient, I would definitely tell you to walk that land and see if you can recognize any spots where water has pooled after a heavy rain and downpour. That means that water or that particular location already has fairly poor soil. Usually, it could also mean that it's just waterlogged, but 9 times out of 10, it means that there is poor soil right there, which is a good place to put a man-made pond of some kind of shape, size, variety. And then what you do is you use the dirt from the excavation of the pond to put swells onto your land to better direct the water toward the pond. That way, you're using gravity to help fill the pond as opposed to just letting it fill on its own through direct rainfall. You're letting the soil and your land to kind of almost cleanse the water, like its own little filter of sorts. As the water comes down in, actually I have a buddy of mine, they have a farm down in North Kakalaki, and, what they did is they had a natural spring, so they put in a pond, but then they dropped, a well head on top of the natural spring to keep the water constantly flowing, from that particular water source. So there's always, you know, and it's, oh, I want to say it's maybe, I don't know, 3 to 5, maybe 10 gallons a minute. I don't know. It's not much. It's just, I don't know. It just, there's always water coming out, but, you know, when it gets so hot down there, that well just never keeps up. But the well and the natural spring actually keep it from going completely dry. And the whole reason that you want one of these things is, one, you can use the water and a pump and go up and water your orchard and your vine crops, your berry bushes, your nut trees, your fruit trees, whatever. But water and the combination of an orchard will attract wildlife. And you can use that as a means to kind of keep yourself fed as an additional protein source to supplement any food that you may have stored in your home for your longer term disruptions, whether it's a minor, a moderate, or a major. I mean, you can definitely, I mean, there's no reason why you can't hunt your own land, and there's no reason you can't, and it's not considered baiting if you make a water source available to wildlife and you hunt your own property. So if that brings in ducks and geese, or if that brings in deer and foxes and raccoons, or, you know, whatever it is, I mean, you can get pelts, you can get an additional source of protein. Bears is another one. If depending on where you live, you can bring in some bear. That's a great pelt to have. So when you're thinking about an orchard, you can't just think, I need a tree. Okay. You need to be thinking, I need a tree for what purpose? And then little by little, you start expanding that circle so that it encompasses water sources. It encompasses additional protein sources in terms of hunting and trapping opportunities. So it, just having an orchard isn't just, I'm going to grow some trees, I'm going to make apple pies, and, you know, what have you. It's not as simple as that if you're going to be thinking long-term preparedness. Because if you get a dehydrator, for example, and you have an orchard, and there's a moderate to a major disruption, you're now a really popular person because you can dehydrate the fruits. You can go, I mean, you got time on your hands, so you can sit around and crack open shells and get almonds and walnuts out. And you can, you know, so you have the means to help kind of supply people if there's a societal breakdown, and you can use that as a means to barter. It would be almost akin to having a fistful of cash. If you have a little baggie with dried apples in it, you know, a family that doesn't prepare is going to look at that bag of dried apples and they're going to go, well, what do you want? You know, you can set your own price at that point. So these are the types of things that I think about all the time. And that's what I want to talk about today was the orchards and the water sources and how to kind of generate your water sources. You can, you know, if you have enough land and you can get two ponds and connect them with a spillway, that would be great. But you definitely want to use that dirt to your advantage, whatever you excavate. And it goes beyond just putting in, you know, kind of water diverting swells on your land to kind of make sure that water gets to where you want it to go. But you can also use those swells to help attract pollinators, because you could go out there and seed bomb it with native grasses and plants and flowers, and that'll help. And it'll, what it'll do is you're kind of making your own little mini meadow, and that'll help attract pollinators, and that'll help your orchard, that'll help your garden, because everybody needs the pollinators. So you need to be thinking about that type of stuff. And you could also, and this is basically called Hugel culture. You can, and we talked about this a little bit in a couple other episodes, but you don't have to seed bomb them all with native grasses and things of that nature. You can go out and You know, you can put a bunch of vine crops on there because that'll attract wildlife as well. Deer love pumpkins. So if you go put a couple pumpkin seeds in those little mounds, those swells, I mean, you're gonna be neck deep in protein come wintertime. So these are the types of things that I think about that I wanted to share with you guys. So I hope you enjoyed it. And that's the show for this week. I think I got one more show in me until the summer hiatus. So be good, be safe, and we'll talk to you next week.
Happy Hunger Games, and may the odds be ever in your favor.